I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, the co-founder of Warby Parker, an online eyeglass retailer that sells vintage-inspired glasses for $95. For each pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker provides a pair of glasses to low-income people in more than 36 countries. Neil co-founded the company in February 2010 with three other classmates from Wharton Business School. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the details of the company, I'd like for you to walk me through the current landscape of the optical industry. What does it look like?
So right now, typically, one walks into an optical shop, they bring a prescription, and they spend several hundred dollars on a pair of glasses. My co-founder, right before we launched, he actually had spent $700 on a pair of glasses and had forgotten them in an airplane and just couldn't justify spending $700 again to replace them while he was a full-time graduate student. So when we look at the industry, we see that it's dominated by one company in particular. It's a publicly traded company called Exotica. They do about $1 billion, $8 billion a year in revenue. They're vertically integrated. They've outright acquired Oakley, Ray-Ban, Oliver Peoples, Persol, and Arnett. They license all the major fashion brands, Ralph Lauren, Chanel, Prada, you name it. They then have systematically bought up all of the retail chains. So they own LensCrafters, Pearle Vision, Sunglass Hut, Sears Optical, and Target Optical. And then the icing on the cake is they own the second largest vision insurance plan in the country, iMed, that also major health plans like Aetna use as their vision plan. So typically, if you were to go into a LensCrafters, you might see 40 different brands of glasses. They're all designed by the same people, manufactured in the same factories, and you might pay for that pair of glasses with your vision insurance, and it's all owned by one company.
Are there any antitrust issues that have come up? Why isn't there more antitrust legislation surrounding them?
Yeah, I'm not a sort of an expert on monopolies, but I know that there was some attention sort of given by sort of the FTC and the Justice Department when they were acquiring Sunglass Hut, when the Justice Department was looking at sort of the number of retail outlets that sell glasses. They were including pharmacies that sell like over-the-counter reading glasses and sunglasses, and when you include those sort of outlets, you know, there are thousands of them, right? Luxottica only has a small percent.
Now, you're wearing Warby Parker glasses. You don't brand your glasses. There's Warby Parker on the inside. Why did you make that decision?
We think that glasses are a reflection of one's personality, and one of our core values is to treat others the way that we want to be treated. And when we were thinking about what glasses we wanted to wear, we didn't want to be a walking billboard for another company, right? We want to be walking billboards of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then we actually did a bunch of research. At the time, we were at Wharton. We had 800 classmates, so we would just hit them with survey after survey after survey, and we found that overwhelmingly, yeah, people didn't want an external logo, and especially when you looked at people that had worked in the creative space, those people were even vehemently against having sort of external branding, and those are the folks that tend to dictate what's cool and are the early adopters, so we really wanted to take them into consideration when we were designing our first collection.
Prior to starting Warby Parker, you were a director at VisionSpring, which is a nonprofit organization founded by optometrist Dr. Jordan Casalow, and their purpose is to also provide low-cost glasses to low-income populations. What were you doing for them?
So I was running all of their operations and programs. So I worked on the pilot program down in El Salvador, basically sort of wrote the manual for how do you train low-income men and women in the developing world to start their own businesses, giving eye exams and selling glasses in their communities. Expanded the program to 10 different countries, started to design glasses for people living on less than $4 a day, and then going to Asia to manufacture them.
VisionSpring has something called a mobile unit. Can you describe that briefly?
There are hundreds of millions of people that don't have access to glasses. And what that means is that generally there aren't people in those communities giving eye exams and selling glasses. So the question is, how do you reach them, especially in like rural India? So VisionSpring innovated and came up with this idea to take a van, packed with people that could do a refraction and glasses and lenses, and would literally sort of set up almost like a soup kitchen for glasses, and you know, make announcements, and people would line up. They come, they get their eyes checked. If they need a pair of glasses, they can buy them on the spot, often for just a few dollars. So even people that are living on less than $4 a day can afford it. And when someone's paying for something, they value it. They're going to use it. You're treating them with dignity because they have the power to decide whether they want that pair of glasses or not. And we found that a pair of, just a simple pair of reading glasses, for example, would increase someone's productivity 35% and their income by 20%.
Now, just as you empower people inherently by forcing them to buy the glasses rather than giving them the glasses, you also allow them choice in, you know, the style of glasses that they wear, which is almost equally important to them. What were your findings there?
At Vision Spring, we had a saying that Jordan coined, that vanity is not monopolized by the rich. People would really rather be blind than wear a pair of donated 1970s cat eyes. And it's because they'll be ridiculed by their friends and neighbors, because ultimately glasses are a reflection of who you are, and fashion matters no matter where you live in the world. So when I was thinking about starting Warby Parker with a few friends, right, those lessons from serving people living on less than $4 a day were exactly the same, right? Glasses, while they have amazing sort of health function, they're ultimately fashion accessories.
You happen to wear eyeglasses. How long have you worn glasses?
So that's the funny thing, is that I really wear glasses as a fashion accessory.
Do you have a prescription in your lenses right now, or are they completely clear?
They're completely clear.
Ooh.
But they are UV protected.
Now, you grew up in New York City. Your mother was a nurse, and your dad was a tax lawyer, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers. What were some odd jobs that you had growing up in New York City?
Well, it was funny. I think my first entrepreneurial experience, I got sucked into one of those direct response TV ads for a food dehydrator, and begged my parents that I could spend $60 on a food dehydrator so that way I could make dried fruit and beef jerky. And all it was a couple plastic trays, a heat coil, and a fan. And what you do is you basically take like grapes, you put it in there for 3 days, and then you get raisins. It ends up being more expensive to try and make them yourself. But my bright idea was to have a food stand on like Mercer Street to sell dried fruit and beef jerky to New Yorkers.
So this was in high school. And you went to Friends Seminary, which is a Quaker high school in New York City, which has a real community focus. What impact do you think that your school had on you, if any?
I think it had a tremendous impact. You know, one of the things that was just core to the curriculum there was community service. Our school and our gym would actually turn into sort of a homeless shelter almost every evening. So if you were there late after school, you know, you'd see it and you'd actually help clean up to prepare for people that were coming in to spend the night.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, co-founder of Warby Parker, a company that sells vintage-inspired glasses. For each pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker gives a pair of glasses to low-income populations internationally through nonprofit partners like Vision Spring. So fast forward to Wharton. You had three friends whom you co-founded the company with. And as you explained before, you had, you know, your classmates as focus groups. What other types of, you know, helpful information did they give you?
Well, an example was, we were trying to build this great brand, and we were trying to figure out how do we name it. It actually was the hardest thing that we did. It took us 6 months. We came up with over 2,000 different names. Finally, we were really inspired by some early writings of Jack Kerouac, and two characters in particular, Warby Pepper and Zag Parker, and we thought that we had something here. So we immediately put together a survey, blasted it out to about 1,600 people, because at Wharton there's 800 people per class, and the results were amazing. First, we asked, you know, what is your gut reaction, sort of negative, neutral, or positive? Overwhelmingly, it was positive. And then it was, what are your sort of associations? And for the most part, people didn't have any associations. So you have this blank canvas from which to work. Mm-hmm. There were a few people that said Warburg Pincus, but we figured, you know, it was a Wharton population, a little focused on finance.
One of your co-founders and co-CEOs, David Gilboa had attended an exhibit at the New York Public Library of Jack Kerouac, which was the catalyst for the idea, right?
Absolutely. We had, you know, when we looked at folks that inspired us, we often looked at literary figures because of the tie between vision and reading. So we took a lot of inspiration aesthetically from our grandparents that went to work in the 40s and 50s, and then sort of the social ethos of our parents that, you know, were coming of age in the 60s and were reading sort of Kerouac and Ginsberg and others.
Incidentally, one of your first marketing presentations was this hush mob at the New York Public Library. Explain that incident.
We were trying to figure out what do we want to do for our fashion presentation, our first time that we were sort of in the scene and during Fashion Week. And what we decided to do was a guerrilla presentation at the New York Public Library. So we took about 30 models, put them in hair and makeup at the Bryant Park Hotel about a block away, snuck them in one by one. We had a couple employees sort of stake out about six tables in the great reading room. And then we had 25 fashion editors come and meet us. We had sent them these letterpress invitations with these vellum reading lists and little library cards. And we said, shh, meet us on 42nd and 5th Avenue in front of the building with the stone lions on it, because we didn't want to say the New York Public Library because we didn't really have permission. And we brought them in, and at 3:30 on the dot, all of the models put on their glasses and then lifted up these books with these bright blue book covers on it with the frame name by Warby Parker. And it just created this amazing visual, this very different sort of fashion show.
Now, the press has been a friend of yours from the beginning. You know, the first few weeks of your launch, you were in GQ and Vogue and Daily Candy. How have you had this love affair with the press? Like, is there one company or one person who really helped to push that forward?
I always say that sort of PR is about 70% messages, 30% the messenger. So we've been trying to be very deliberate in thinking about what is interesting for people to report on, and then, of course, get the right messengers. So we, in sort of when we were launching the company, there was only three things we invested in: our first collection, the website, and PR, knowing that you only have one shot to launch a lifestyle brand. And we just leveraged every personal connection possible. I mean, my wife, Rachel, has a contemporary jewelry line called Rachel Lee, and she used to work in PR at Yves Saint Laurent, so we really leveraged a bunch of her relationships.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, co-founder of Warby Parker. We'll hear more from Neil coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, the co-founder of Warby Parker, a company that sells vintage-inspired glasses. For each pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker gives a pair of glasses to low-income populations internationally through nonprofit partners like Vision Spring. Incidentally, when you were at Vision Spring, you actually rebranded the organization. It used to be called the Skojo Foundation. How did that change in marketing and just branding impact what you carried over to Warby Parker?
Well, when I was at Vision Spring and we were working on the rebranding, we worked with this amazing creative group called What If, and we went through all these different exercises that I remembered that then when Jeff, Andy, Dave, and I were thinking about the brand architecture for Warby Parker that we went through. So an example would be, what are you and what aren't you? So an example would be Warby Parker's collegiate, but we're not preppy. And getting into those very specific nuances is really the essence of a brand, thinking about what type of, if we were a car, what type of car we'd be. If we were a jeans company, what type of jeans would we be? Thinking about different reference images. So one image that we kept coming back to was the blue-footed booby. And, you know, I can't say it without laughing, and that was one of the reasons why we loved it, because who doesn't love a booby?
What is a booby?
It's this great sort of penguin-like bird that's found in the Galapagos. So for one thing, you kind of need to be knowledgeable and worldly to even know it exists. Because it kind of looks like a penguin, it's sort of sharp and sophisticated and has like a tuxedo. But then when you pan down, you see it has these bright blue webbed feet. So it's got this sort of unexpected sort of pop to it. And then when you look at its face, almost all these photos of the blue-footed booby, it has this sort of quizzical, comical look on its face that's very curious. And that's also sort of part of who we are.
Just the name, blue-footed booby. Like, if it recalled anything more serious, it
wouldn't work.
You co-founded the company with three of your classmates, which can be kind of risky, starting a company with your friends. But you kind of had this pact early on of staying friends no matter what. And what were some concrete things that you put in place to ensure that?
Yeah, it's funny. I vividly remember that first night that we decided to move forward. We were sitting at a bar, and we basically promised each other two things. One was that we were going to work really hard, and the second that we were going to remain friends throughout the process. And we knew that there had been so many really smart people that had made similar pledges but weren't able to keep them. So we thought, what could we do, you know, systematically to sort of maintain these friendships and maintain a healthy working dynamic? And we created monthly 360 reviews where we'd go back to the same bar. The four of us would sit there. One person would be in the hot seat at a time, and we'd say, hey, you're doing this well. Hey, this can be improved. Hey, when you shoot me a 10-page email at 2 in the morning, I want to kill you. And it really helped any sort of issues to surface immediately and for us to resolve it and for us to just become, you know, a high-functioning team.
You had 360 reviews monthly. What were some issues that your partners had with you?
I think sometimes I'm known for immediately jumping into action and maybe not thinking things through as much as my three other co-founders. So sometimes it's, hey, Neil, slow it down a bit.
And does your wife say the same thing?
Sometimes, definitely. I tend to plan trips and then not really pack for them.
Now, David Gilboa, incidentally, in addition to being one of the co-founders and the co-CEO, he's also the fastest marathon runner who has run in a flamingo costume. And he's hiked across Antarctica.
Indeed, one of our core values is to inject fun and quirkiness into everything that we do. So we take Halloween very seriously. Every year, we decorate the office for a week, and we have everybody dress up and come to the office in full costume on a day that's not Halloween, so it makes for some pretty awkward subway rides.
What have you been?
Last year, I was Annie, Little Orphan Annie. And it was a little awkward. We had about 15 MIT students visiting that day, and I was giving a talk to them in this really small skirt.
Did you sing?
I didn't sing, but I'm hoping that it was memorable.
The four founders worked together as equal partners since inception and while you were still at Wharton. And then upon graduation in spring 2010, you and David Gilboa became co-CEO. Why do you think that was necessary?
You know, I think it would have been weird to have a reporting relationship between the two of us, regardless of who was going to be a superior and who was going to be the subordinate. And I think the other thing is that our skill sets complemented each other pretty well, so we were able to do it in an organized fashion. So we sort of split the business up into about 12 different departments, six roll up into me, six roll up into Dave. Ultimately, we have created mechanisms in case there is a disagreement. You know, for one thing, we each have the final say in our areas of responsibility, and then we, you know, work closely with our board on sort of major strategic issues.
Since it's still a private company, you could do whatever you want, until...
Yeah, until we have activist shareholders.
Okay. In the early days, when you launched, to your surprise, orders vastly outpaced your inventory. How did you respond to that imbalance?
Yeah, you know, we went from this moment where it was like, oh my God, our idea is actually working to, oh crap, we're not going to be able to serve our customers. And the whole idea was to provide access, right? And within 48 hours, we had to shut down our home try-on program. Within 3 weeks, we hit our first year sales targets. Within 4 weeks, sold out of our top 15 styles. So we immediately had to just come out and sort of tell our customers, hey, we're really sorry. You know, we didn't expect there to be this much of a response. We're going to do everything possible to sort of get more inventory faster, but we're not going to take your credit card just now, and we're not going to charge you.
You took out loans from the bank shortly thereafter. How much capital did you have in those early days?
So we, the four of us, invested our life savings in the company. It was under $150,000. And then we ended up getting a $200,000 term loan that was backed by the Small Business Administration. That was difficult to get. Took us about 14 banks, even though every loan officer we saw said, wow, you know, this is really impressive business plan. You have all this traction. Our hands are tied. We can't make loans to companies that haven't been around for at least 2 years and have 2 years of tax returns. And this was coming off the heels of the 2008 financial crisis, where a lot of banks had to quickly implement measures to sort of rein in lending. We ended up leveraging a personal relationship. One thing that was interesting was that we had to put up $100,000 of our own capital to secure this $200,000 loan, even though it was backed up to 90% by the federal government. And that was because the bank said, listen, at the end of the day, if you don't pay, it's too much of a headache to try and get the federal government to reimburse us. Mm-hmm. Which was a little upsetting, knowing just I think that the SBA is a great thing, but just how can we sort of streamline it to make sure that's functioning as it should.
Did you also raise capital from friends and family? No venture, right?
At that point, no. It was about 18 months after we launched that we did our first equity raise, and that we had a mix of friends and family, of angel funds, and then actually individuals from the fashion and entertainment worlds. So people like Ashton Kutcher, Ari Emanuel, the CEO of William Morris Endeavor, Joel Horowitz, the former CEO and co-founder of Tommy Hilfiger, the family that owns Chanel. We really wanted sort of a diverse group that could help us build the next great lifestyle brand.
Now, you also looked at Zappos as some type of inspiration for you, the shoe company now owned by Amazon. What are one or two examples of that?
From day one, it was how do we make buying glasses as easy as possible? So it's free shipping, free returns, hiring really talented people to sort of work in customer service and actually be in sort of like a call center. People think that it's crazy that we're managing sort of a call center in the middle of Soho using sort of graduates from top universities. But we're finding that, they're able to deliver amazing customer experience, and this is a great marketing tool. When we measure customer satisfaction using Net Promoter Score, our score is a 91, which is higher than Apple and Zappos. And it ends up being a great sort of recruiting tool and a feeder to all of our other departments.
What has surprised you about the company? Like, what has been harder for you than you thought?
I don't know if we fully appreciated the technological challenges of sort of building a technology-enabled brand and somebody that sells primarily through e-commerce. So the four of us that started the company aren't technical, and it took us a while to sort of hire engineers, software engineers, developers, coders. There's actually a real sort of lack of engineering talent in the U.S. right now. It's limiting our growth, and it's limiting our ability to hire in other areas because we just don't have enough technical talent.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Neil Blumenthal, the co-founder of Warby Parker, a company that sells vintage-inspired glasses. The company has a home try-on option where it will send you five glasses that you choose on the website to try on at home for free. Incidentally, we were talking about Luxottica and, you know, just how the industry is controlled really by one or two companies. You are a David in comparison to this Goliath, but have you had any communication with them? Have they paid any attention to you?
Yeah, we had a brief conversation with them. I think it was almost a year ago or so. It was funny. We were meeting at their offices, and Dave and I told our team, if we're not back in 2 hours, call the cops. But no, it was a very open dialogue, sort of, you know, wondering if there's an opportunity for us to work together. You know, I have a lot of respect for the business that they've built, and I think that they're always sort of looking at, hey, what are some companies in the eyewear industry that are doing interesting things?
You're primarily an online company, though your face-to-face encounters with customers have been pretty important for the growth of the company. And in a way, you're marrying e-commerce with bricks and mortar. Can you describe that dichotomy a little bit?
So what we found was that when we were working out of our apartments in Philadelphia while we were full-time students and we had run out of a bunch of inventory, people started calling us and saying, "Hey, I heard you're in Philadelphia. Can we come to your office?" And we'd say, "You can come to my apartment." And people would show up. I remember the first person was a resident, and he came in with his scrubs, and we laid out the glasses on the dining room table, tried to make the apartment look as nice as possible. And we thought it was going to be this really suboptimal experience, but figured, what the hell, you know, we'll give it a shot. And it ended up being a really special experience because for the customer, they got a chance to meet the people behind the brand, which is so rare these days. And this particular person went on to be one of our biggest advocates. So when we moved back to New York and we set up our office, we made sure to make sure that our first office was in Union Square, that was easily accessible by subway, that it was southern facing and had light coming in, and we had a small showroom to the point where people just started coming in, and we got into huge fights with our landlord because they're like, "You can't be running a store out of here. This is a commercial space. This is, should be an office," and the elevator broke, and it was a big disaster. Now we've since moved to the Puck Building on House and Lafayette, where on the fifth floor, we have a 600-square-foot showroom. Last month, we did over $250,000 worth of sales. When you look at it on a sales per square foot basis, right, that's approaching levels of Tiffany's and Apple, which, you know, it's crazy when you think about we're selling a $95 pair of glasses, you know, on the fifth floor of a non-retail building.
When you first launched the company, you were out of your apartments in Pennsylvania and you moved to New York. You then used your wife's office as the Warby Parker headquarters. How was that?
It was funny. We were all scrunched into sort of the back of her office, which was right in the Fashion District on 38th Street. And it was the summer, and it was just so hot. And her air conditioning units were positioned towards the front. So the first thing that we had to do was buy a fan. And then sometimes customers would come into the office, and, you know, you talk about being confused, right? It's an office building. The name on the door says Rachel Lee, not Warby Parker. And then you have to go to the back of the office to try on glasses. And you see all these people huddled around on laptops.
I want to go back to the partnership with VisionSpring. What are some stories or, you know, memories that you have of individuals whom you've helped, whether it was in El Salvador or India?
So I was recently in India, and I met a carpenter. And this was a carpenter who sort of had sort of the biggest wood shop in the neighborhood and made sort of beautiful furniture, pretty ornate. And his business started to suffer basically over the last couple of years as he was having trouble seeing. And he started to basically have to outsource the sort of the most value-add work. And, you know, All that he needed was a simple pair of over-the-counter reading glasses. So when VisionSpring visited his town, he was able to sort of buy those glasses. And literally within a few days, his business was back up to where it was a few years previously. And it's just, you know, there's story after story about that. I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a town that might be like a weaving community, and I'll sit in front of like 20 women and I'll ask them, "Who has trouble seeing?" And nobody will raise their hand. And then I'll say, "Well, who has trouble threading a needle?" And everybody will raise their hand. So often we had to link sort of activities to vision and sort of prove that, hey, glasses are sort of the solution here.
Anything else?
Yeah. One of the other things is sort of how do you market to people living on less than $4 a day in these communities? You know, we sometimes get crazy questions like, "Oh, when does the medicine run out?" when we're talking about glasses. One of the other things that we'd find is that early on, we learned that you need to build up credibility for the people that we're training over time, because we're training people from these communities where they've sort of grown up and gone to school with their neighbors over their entire lifetime, for them to sort of come back after a couple days training and say, hey, I can give eye exams and sell glasses, it's just outside of the realm of believability. So we had to create posters that said, you know, like vision entrepreneur in training, and give people sort of lab coats and ID cards and certificates of training, so that way they could sort of prove to their friends and family that, hey, they had gone through this rigorous training. They do have the capacity to, you know, give these eye exams and sell glasses.
Pretty universal.
Absolutely.
Your wife is a jewelry designer. What impact, if any, did she have aesthetically on the brand or on the glasses?
So there pretty much isn't a pair of glasses that we design that she doesn't sort of give an opinion on. I think we do follow her opinions almost all the time. So it's great to have sort of another person with a great aesthetic for us to sort of turn to. She has a great glasses face, and almost any pair of glasses sort of looks good on her. So we're able to always throw on different glasses on her to see if, you know, if we think it's going to work.
I know what you mean when you say she has a great glasses face. Some people wear glasses well and others just doesn't work.
Yeah,
kind of like caps. You know,
yeah.
Some guys can handle caps, baseball caps,
right.
And others just, you know, keep it off.
It's like Matt Lauer.
The host of the Today Show.
He was an eyeglass model for a while.
Huh.
And what was pretty neat was when we were on the Today Show, he was basically, every pair of glasses looked great on him. He even played with our monocle. And monocles even looked good on Matt Lauer.
Since you're so focused on the face and on eyeglasses in particular, really for the last decade, do you notice yourself, you know, recognizing things or noticing details that you might not have otherwise prior?
I think my wife yells at me for looking in the mirror for too long, but no, I can't walk down the street without staring people down if they're wearing eyeglasses or sunglasses, and to the point where they probably think, who is this weirdo staring at me?
Are you trying to figure out, are those my glasses, or what are you looking at?
Well, that's generally easy to do, and I remember the first time that I saw somebody wearing our glasses, it was at the Union Square train station. This gentleman was on the platform, and he sort of walked by me, and I kind of like was following with him, and he was kind of looking back like, who's this weirdo? Is he going to push me off the platform? But no, I just wanted to see our first sort of customer in the wild, so to speak.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Neil Blumenthal, co-founder of Warby Parker. Coming up, we'll meet Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment, including iPhones, BlackBerries, iPads, and recent Apple computers, among other items. The company was launched in 2006 and has recycled more than 1 million devices since inception. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
Could you please describe how Gazelle works? Let's say I have a BlackBerry Curve that I want to get off my hands.
What you do is go to our website, either on the desktop or on your mobile device, and look up the specific model that you want to sell. You'll answer a couple of simple questions about the condition of the item, and you get a price. And if you like the price, you'll give us your shipping address so we can send you packaging, and we'll pay for the shipping. As soon as you put the item in the mailbox and ship it to us, we'll receive it, inspect it, make sure that it's as described by you, and then send you the payment.
Now, you're a consumer-facing business, but it hasn't always worked this way. You initially tried partnering with businesses when you first launched. Can you describe that experience and some examples of that?
We've gone through quite an evolution. So in the early days, what we wanted to do is access consumers that buy product, and what a better place than go to Best Buy, go to Radio Shack, go to Amazon, eBay, where consumers buy new product, and help those companies, those retailers, offer a trading service to their customer base. It just made a lot of sense. what the struggle was back then was that the economy was flourishing, the whole sustainability movement was just getting started, and frankly, this was not top on anybody's list.
And was there a catalyst or a specific event that really gave you the engine and the motivation to say, okay, we're going to change direction?
Yes, it's quite memorable. So we spent a lot of time with Best Buy. In April of 2007, we got a call in the evening basically saying that while they appreciate all the work that we've put into developing the program with them, they were going to pass. We were running out of cash. And again, we either had to close shop or change direction in a very aggressive way.
You also changed course at an auspicious moment. The economy was collapsing, which ironically was beneficial for the company. How come?
It was very beneficial to Gazelle because the biggest opportunity was to build awareness that all the stuff that's in your drawers, in your closets, that you know, the 5-year-old BlackBerry, the 3-year-old laptop that you're not using anymore, has a value. It's collecting dust. So in the early days, it was really all about cash for your gadgets that you're not using, as opposed to where it is today, much more on upgrading.
The number of devices that you accept is roughly less than 500. But back then, it was over, what, 200,000?
It was hundreds of thousands, including movies and games and GPS systems. Was everything under the sun except for TVs.
And what percent of these devices do you actually are you able to resell versus that you're stuck with?
Everything has value. The only question is how much. From day one, everything that we acquired and paid value for, we were able to turn around and sell at a profit. So currently, we resell 100% of the product. Or if it's not 100%, it's 98, 99%. The interesting thing about this business, which has always fascinated me, is that it's a supply-constrained business. Demand is insatiable.
You have spoken about the car trade-in business as an analogy to what you're doing. What parallels or similarities do you see, and what would you like to replicate?
Sure. So in the car business, 40 to 50% of all new car sales have a trade-in involved in it. So it's so consumer behavior around trade-in, to your point, is inherent in the way we buy new cars. That figure for consumer electronics is about 3%. Inertia is a very strong kind of human behavior, consumer behavior. When you buy the new, let's say, iPhone, you don't care a whole lot about the old device. It's sort of your ex at the time. So building awareness for the value of the devices and then convincing consumers that there is a service out there in Gazelle that provides a much easier, much more convenient, much faster, much safer way to get that value for your device is a challenge, a marketing challenge for us.
So when you buy these devices, whom are you selling the used devices to?
I would say it falls into three different categories. The biggest market is in the emerging countries, Southeast Asia. It goes into the Philippines, into Malaysia. The Middle East is a big market, Nigeria. A second category of buyers are insurance companies. When you lose your phone, you drop it in the water, well, you're not getting a new one. The third would be consumers that don't get the warranty or consumers that want to buy a used laptop, a used iPad for their kids maybe.
They'll go to
eBay, they'll go to Amazon, they'll go to our store. Mm-hmm. On those marketplaces and buy directly from us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Personal circumstances caused you to move back to Boston in 2006. You at the time had been living in the San Francisco area, but your wife wanted to move back to her hometown in Boston. Can you describe that moment?
It was obviously a very important moment in our relationship. And we had an 18-month-old, we had an 8-week-old, two girls. And, you know, both I and my wife, both of us grew up with lots of family around us. And my family was in Israel at the time. And we tried once to fly to Israel from the Bay Area. And it was a complete disaster with the baby crying for 10 straight hours on the flight. And it was time to pack up, move to Boston and be close to family. Hmm. And figure out the career stuff later.
Right. You mentioned that your family was in Israel. You actually were born in Peru and spent the first 5 or 6 months of your life in Peru. What brought your parents to Peru initially?
So my dad spent 25 years with the Israeli army He specialized in training of tanks. I guess at the time, in 1970, the Israeli army was in the process of selling tanks to the Peruvian army. I was born there, and they spent about a year there before moving back to Israel.
Were your parents in Israel when the country was founded after World War II?
Both of them were. My dad was born in Bulgaria, so he moved to Israel 3 years before the country was founded. My mom actually was born in Jerusalem under the British mandate.
You spent the first 18 years of your life roughly in Israel. What was the reason for moving to the United States?
Yes, so my parents in the late 80s, it was actually pretty tough times in Israel in terms of a very prolonged recession. Nobody in my family has ever been to college at the time, and they just felt that education and just giving us an opportunity was their life mission. And I guess they said it's now or never, and just got on the plane and moved here with absolutely no prospects for a job.
So you get off the plane, and what next?
What next? So first, you're intimidated by moving to New York. It was really scary, actually, in the early days. My father scrambling to find a job, my mom looking for a job, I was looking for a job, and it was really all about survival.
What were some of the early jobs you got?
It was for a video store. It was 77th Street and Lexington Avenue, okay. Video Vogue, no longer there. And they were selling consumer electronics in the front. I grew up just loving watching movies. So the idea of working at a store, even was at $4 an hour, bringing movies home and watching them for free, was very appealing to me. I started working there and really didn't have a plan for where to take it.
What else about, just in addition to building a work ethic and having to scramble, how else did working in the video store influence
right.
you? I mean, there were electronics in the front of the store. Was there any resonance there?
Well, basically, the purpose of the store was to serve the clientele of the Upper East Side and provide the highest possible customer service known to mankind.
Okay.
So some of the customers were Woody Allen, Robin Williams, Ron Perlman, and they were just very demanding customers. So it was all about doing whatever it takes. But frankly, for me, it was a shock to the system. My first images were not kind of happy memories of watching movies. Was my first winter in New York, delivering movies on my feet while it was snowing and blizzards on the streets, going 10, 20 blocks on Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, delivering movies to those glamorous apartments, mansions in Manhattan. Just my jaw was dropping every time I was dropping off a movie in some of those places. That was cleaning the toilet, frankly, and cleaning the shelves and making sure the store looked good and that it was welcoming to our customers. Those were their early days at Video Vogue.
So moving from Video Vogue to NYU, where you finally went to college and got a degree, what were your ambitions professionally? Were you just trying to make ends meet, or did you have some longer-term plan?
So living in New York, it was kind of natural to gravitate to the finance world. I don't remember the name of the book, but I remember a book that was written about the life of Ron Perlman. It was coincidentally a weekend day that he stopped by.
Ron Perlman being the
Revlon guy, the corporate raider of the 1980s. Which started to get me thinking about Wall Street. The movie Wall Street obviously came out in 1987. And I feel that's something that I could actually pursue.
What were your parents doing, incidentally? What kind of jobs did they hold?
So my dad was a limo driver, a car service driver. And my mom worked at one of the Israeli newspapers.
After you graduated from NYU, your first job outside of college was at Harvard Business School writing cases for them. And one of the cases you happened to help write was about Microsoft, where you went out to Seattle and you wrote about Bill Gates. Can you describe any interesting tidbits from that experience?
Yeah, that experience clearly planted a seed in me about the future of technology. And one of the things that Bill Gates said at the office, we spent about 3 hours with him. One thing that he said that I'll never forget was that Israel, one of the best ways to change the world is through technology, which has become evident over the years, obviously, with the companies like Microsoft and others. But for me personally, coming from my business background, my finance background, I frankly didn't know who Bill Gates was. I was barely using email at the time, let alone Windows. So that was a whole new world to me. Now, at the time, I didn't know what to do with it. Other than the fact that it was intriguing and interesting, I still had that Wall Street bug in me, so I had to go back and get it out of my system.
So you ultimately went to Goldman Sachs and graduated from HBS and got the Wall Street bug out of you. And then you begin a whole new chapter professionally, which is really in startups and e-commerce. Even though you were an employee at these companies, you still had this entrepreneurial itch because in 1997, actually while you were still at Goldman Sachs, you co-authored a business plan for a startup called Cosmo.com, which at the time was an internet-based video rental business,
right,
which at one point had a $1 billion valuation in 99.
Yes, they actually filed the S-1 in March of 2000, and they were ready to go public.
How did you come to be on the founding team of Cosmo?
So one of my cubemates at Goldman was the co-founder of Cosmo, and he came up with the notion of the idea behind Cosmo right after the Amazon IPO. He approached me because he knew about my experience working at Video Vogue, and we worked together for about 6 months, nights and weekends, developing the business plan, coming up with the name, and at the end of the day, he decided to leave Goldman and pursue it full-time and build Cosmo. I decided to go back to business school.
Were there any impressions from that experience that you've carried with you?
That the world was going to change. It was pretty clear that the world was about to change and the internet was going to revolutionize everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle, a company that resells used electronic equipment. Prior to starting Gazelle, Israel worked as a research analyst at Goldman Sachs and a finance director at eBay and PayPal. What were some important impressions from eBay or your PayPal experience that have carried over to Gazelle?
What was amazing about that time is to spend 2 years with entrepreneurs in those markets, building their companies from scratch, learning about their challenges of building a business, how they think about an exit strategy, whether eBay was going to buy them, an IPO, a different kind of partnership. So I just soaked up all that knowledge. That was really helpful for me to get a glimpse of what it's like to be an entrepreneur in all those different markets.
I want to go back to the early days of Gazelle for a moment. I want to talk about venture capital. In 2008, even though you had this auspicious moment where the economy was collapsing and people wanted to, you know, resell their items, the economy was collapsing. So their, you know, venture capitalists did not have their checkbooks open. What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, first thing I'll say, it was never easy to raise capital in my experience at Gazelle. But the context of when you raise money obviously is critical. And you're raising a good point. So in late 2008, we were raising our second round of capital. So the first round was completed in 2007. Venrock, who incidentally was one of the early investors in Apple, was the lead investor of the Series A. Now, in November of 2008, we were ready to close the B round with Rockport Capital. And I'll never forget the day when we were going to close the deal. That was one of the days that the Dow was fell 1,000 points. And I was really nervous about, is this deal going to close? And I remember at the time, even the Rockport guys, I mean, they still wanted to pursue it, but everybody was getting cold feet. There was the week after the, I don't know if you remember, the Sequoia presentation came out about how the world was going to come to an end and investments were going to shut down and companies had to scale back their growth ambitions. And here we are, pitching a story about growth and about how this is the, you know, the recession and this dynamics in the market was one of the best things that ever happened to Gazelle. So it helped us push the deal through and get it done. But was it easy? Absolutely not.
You co-founded Gazelle with Rousseau Aurelien and James Michelini. Even before you came on board, Rousseau and James were seriously flirting with this concept, and they had borrowed $60,000 to buy used equipment that they then repurposed and sold on eBay for $500,000. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so that was fascinating for me when I met with Rousseau, and he was telling me that story in terms of the success they were having, and his point was, everything sells a good profit. The only challenge that we have is getting more equipment. And that was kind of the foundation for the idea for Gazelle and Recommerce. At the time, the whole consumer electronics business on eBay was a $14 billion business. It was just a lot of demand.
So it was Rousseau who had the initial idea for this re-commerce, recycling business.
Yeah, what I love the most about Rousseau is such an amazing guy. He's the true visionary guy. Amor, the guy with 2 feet on the ground, getting stuff done. He was really the visionary guy. What really sold me on joining him and, James was his grand vision. And his grand vision was to introduce the concept of trade-ins into other consumer categories, starting with electronics, but also sporting goods, golf clubs, fashion items, IT equipment, servers, etc. So the vision was big. Now, pretty quickly after joining the team and we started actually thinking about developing a plan, we had to start somewhere in a narrow focus.
Now, Rousseau is from Haiti.
Yes. And we went together through the earthquake in Haiti, where his parents' house was completely demolished by the earthquake, and they moved to the U.S. and kind of seeing him going through that period, you know, tough period in his life, his family's life, was interesting and, you know, something I could definitely empathize with.
Simultaneously, while Rousseau and James were pursuing this concept on the East Coast, while you were still back west, you wanted to recycle your own mobile equipment. What was that story?
The story was I moved back here, before I knew about Rousseau, I went down to a retail store and tried to recycle a couple of BlackBerry phones. And I go in and I ask the guy how much for these phones, and the guy goes, $20. He said, $20, I can sell them on eBay for $75. And he goes, no, actually, we're going to charge you $20 for the privilege of recycling. And that was when I had this big aha moment. The consumers are not going to pay for the privilege of recycling. And that's how, you know, the idea of re-commerce kind of started to germinate in my head.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My guest has been Israel Ganot, the co-founder of Gazelle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.